From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Like pretty much everywhere else on the planet, people in the West are worried about the future of the environment. In particular, the fragmentation of wildlife habitat as we humans continue to grow and alter the landscape. Recently, a dissenting voice has emerged within the conservation movement. Some are questioning whether the strategies of the past are outdated. So today in the program, we're talking about what's working in conservation and what isn't. We're live in Montana today in Centennial Valley. We're at a center operated by the University of Utah and focused on the environmental humanities, asking these questions. What if environmentalists didn't treat industry as an adversary but a partner? Would that be better for wildlife, or would it just make it worse? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So let's stipulate biodiversity is declining in the American West. Wildlife habitat is becoming more and more fragmented. The conflict continues between conservation efforts and the private sector. The conservationist Harvey Locke says, in the West, we live with a strange mix of wild mountains, transformed plains, marginalized aboriginal people, optimism, resentment, and a confused future. But there's an even an arguably larger issue affecting not just the West, but of course everywhere, and that's the warming of the planet. And that is raising big questions for the conservation movement and its direction forward. Voices within the movement are saying climate change means there's a larger dynamic of destruction that has to be confronted, which means another way of thinking, new approaches, and a reevaluation of the old ones. And that's what we're talking about today. We're broadcasting live from Montana in the eastern foothills of the Continental Divide. Holy crap, you should see it. We're in Centennial Valley in the town, if you can call it that, of Lakeview, which once served as a stagecoach stop for tourists on their way to Yellowstone. These days, it's a wildlife refuge and a center run by the University of Utah, focused on using the humanities to enrich environmental studies. It's called the Taft-Nicholson Center, and we're in the center of town, sort of, in a big tent, talking about the future of the conservation movement. We have with us Terry Tempest Williams. You may recognize that name, of course. She is a naturalist, an activist, a writer. She's the Annie Clark Tanner Scholar in Environmental Humanities at the University of Utah. Among her books, Refuge, The Open Space of Democracy. And Terry, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Louisa Wilcox is also with us, a conservation advocate who has worked for the National Resources Defense Council, the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, and the Sierra Club. She co-authored the book, The Bare Essentials for Recovery, an Alternative Strategy for Long-Term Restoration. And Louisa Wilcox, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Harvey Locke, I mentioned his name earlier. He's with us, a conservationist, a writer and photographer, founder of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative, which is aimed at creating a continuous wildlife corridor from Yellowstone National Park to the Yukon. Also founder of the Nature Needs Half movement. And Harvey Locke, welcome to you.
Thanks.
And John Varley is with us. He's a biologist who spent some 33 years with the National Park Service in Yellowstone. He retired as founding director of the Yellowstone Center for Resources. He's also served as executive director of the Big Sky Institute, which is a science and outreach institute at Montana State University. And John Varley, welcome to you.
Delighted to be here, Doug.
I wanted to begin broadly, first of all, and get a sort of a brief response. Well, because we'll get into the details as we go, I'm hoping. But I'm wondering if you all agree with the premise that the conservation community is kind of at a crossroads right now, where these new approaches and these new ideas are in order. John Varley, you first.
I think it is at a crossroads, and I wander between dismay and enthusiasm, depending upon what I see. It given the economics of the United States, it seems that less and less money goes to conservation-oriented enterprise these days, and it does take money to make these things happen.
Harvey, what do you think?
I'm at a crossroads, but probably for different reasons than the critics you're thinking of would put it there. I think it's time for us to invent a new story in the 21st century where we think of nature's needs first and how we humans fit in as one species among many. And I actually think what we need to do is actually remember what the first inhabitants of the West knew, which is we live on Mother Earth, and as one species among many, we need to think about that. And I think it's an exciting time because we need a new story by which to live, or we're going to have a very dark 21st century.
Louisa?
Thank you. I think we really are at a crossroads. I have worked in conservation for 35 years. I have seen many changes, some good and some problematic. I think that there is a real problem with some of the large environmental groups, with an ossification, a lack of creativity, a lack of understanding about local needs. And really effective conservation involves a combination of local, state, national, and personal individual interests. So I work on grizzly bears, and grizzly bears can die from dog food on a porch or from policies that the Obama administration invokes relative to oil and gas. So if you don't deal with all of those, and I don't see many groups actually having the imagination and the creativity to do that, you will fail. I agree with Harvey that we need a new narrative, but I also think we need skills. And the kind of skills that are here, the humanities and the sciences, are what we need.
Terry, what about you?
I would say, alongside the phrase crossroads, transition. We've never been here before. And I think that it's too much to place the blame or the responsibility on the conservation organizations alone. I think conservation has to return to our communities where each person takes ownership. And as Michael Soule, the great conservation biologist, says, it is time for an emotional call to arms.
I want to work our way there to the particulars of all of those things that you're talking about. But we have to talk about, I think, what Harvey mentioned are some critics within the movement, because I wanted to get your sort of specific response to it. Because the question really is, to what extent the conservation movement needs to change and in what kinds of ways. And let me mention one of the more controversial approaches, obviously, that's come up for the conservation movement over the last couple of years. 2012, three conservation scientists published a really controversial article that raised some deeply critical questions about the environmental movement. Among them was a man named Peter Kariva. He's a scientist with the conservation group, the Nature Conservancy. And Kariva said the movement, conservation movement, has been fighting the battle for nature on the wrong terrain in the wrong language. He said what was missing from the picture was an acknowledgement of the reality of human beings and our influence on the environment. He wrote this: conservation cannot promise a return to pristine pre-human landscapes. Humankind has already transformed the planet and will continue to do so. What conservation could promise instead is a new vision of a planet in which nature exists amid a wide variety of human landscapes. Now, let me get your reaction to that. That this is one of the things that they're missing out on. I'm not sure where you want to start. Louisa, you want to start? What do you make of that question, that criticism?
Peter Kariva would rely on large corporations to save the planet and have, I think in his vision, postage stamps of wildness surrounded by people. I mean, that is his vision, that it will be confined. It will be paid for. And I think that's wrongheaded. I think that's wrongheaded because it misses kind of the point that Terry made, which is it really is up to us. I think we need to go back. There's a Zen saying.
Hold on. You're jumping ahead. I do want to get to what you believe, because I've read your Zen saying, and I really want to talk about it because I think it's crucial.
Okay.
We're heading there, but let's hold off for just a minute, because okay. I want to get everyone to react to this very critical criticism. Terry, what do you make of it?
I think it's a trust in technology and the supremacy of humans.
That's where Peter's coming from?
Which I believe is based on arrogance and ignorance, or a trust and a belief in evolution and 500 million years of adaptations, which I think is based on humility and the wild. And I would defer to Harvey, who I think has written eloquently about this. I think Kariva is the latest vogue, the latest trend. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was Bill Cronin. And, you know, with the great subtitle, Reinventing Nature. I'd love to know how one does that. And so I think it's, with all due respect, Doug, tiresome, because it takes us off point of what is really at stake here. Mm-hmm. It is not about arguments. It's about saving the planet.
Harvey, what do you think?
Well, think of the statement, nature exists within a wide variety of human landscapes. That is, simply put, lunacy. We humans live inside nature. The context for all life is the natural environment of the world. We don't know how to make air. We don't know how to make water. We don't know how to make food. We know how to manipulate it, but we don't know how to create food. Now, we are one species among many on planet Earth, and inside, and the space inside that is called human society, where we live, and then inside that is the economy. And we have gotten into this crazy place where we think that the economy is the god that we all worship, and that nature has to fit in around. And it's a form of deeply misguided misunderstanding of how the world works. And the other piece of this that's important is that this essay called Conservation in the Anthropocene, which you're referring to,
right,
is actually a postmodern critique of the environmental movement, more than it's a call for changed methods. And you can see that in the way they call people like John Muir and Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Rachel Carson tyrannical oppressors, how Yellowstone was created by killing Indians, which did not happen.
He said they're myths. They're myths, these.
Yeah, well, postmodernism, at foundation, postmodernism is destroy all narratives and then localize all authority and then try to pretend that somehow if local people have authority and control, we'll save grizzly bears. There is no experience anywhere in the world that would support that, no empirical evidence that supports it. But it's a very popular postmodern worldview. And frankly, our environmental movement, there's two foes we know. We know the foe in front of us who says, mind this planet first and we'll get to the next ones later. What we haven't seen is in the shadow lurks the postmodernist with a knife that they stabs from behind. That's what that group is. And I believe we have to start confronting it and surfacing it and deconstructing the postmodern approach to conservation and not giving it the pass where they just get to critique us. Hmm.
John, what do you think? Are you worried that this is dividing the conservation movement, or as Terry is suggesting, it's just sort of another trend that has emerged?
I tend to agree with Terry on this one. There's no doubt that we're going through an earth-shaking event, so to speak. During my watch at Yellowstone Park, I remember when we used to throw up our hands when we got some air pollution from Southern California. Which didn't happen often, but it happened. I mean, you could see it in the precipitation measurements, and then all of a sudden, then this whole notion of global climate change happened, and we found we were consistently getting air quality measurements that originated in Eastern Asia. And that they were over Yellowstone 16 to 18 days after they were emitted in Eastern Asia, and that changed the scale. of things. That regular pollution that was coming over that one little regional spot. And the story, as science is unfolding it, is getting grim. We are dependent, for example, on one tiny organism, a cyanobacteria called Prochlorococcus. And scientists now believe that it produces, it's in all of the oceans, and scientists now believe that it produces most of the oxygen on Earth, and the difficulty is that as the oceans absorb carbon dioxide that is being produced by humanity, that acidifies the ocean, and Prochlorococcus does not like that, and so these are these are huge events going on that threaten our own existence, let alone all of the other wildlife on Earth. And what Terry said, I think, is true. To this extent, where we are now in first understanding what we are doing and how we are interdependent upon all of the other organisms on Earth is just a hugely important thing. So our very definition of wildlife has to change. We've got to alter our vision about what wildlife is, which up to now has been the charismatic megafauna, like bison and elk and grizzly bears and gray wolves and so forth, and start thinking of Prochlorococcus.
Right. I want to come back to some of those ideas as we go. Before we move away from this. Do you think there's anything about if the science is wrong, or if the approach of Peter Kareeb and some other of these conservation scientists is wrong? Are there elements you think that they may have a point about? There's the question of that this is an enterprise, or has been anyway, of mostly elites, white, affluent, highly educated people, now aging, haven't been able to really connect to this younger generation. There's some concern about that. Clinging to older language, older myths that isn't seeming to be connecting. I mean, do you think there's anything to, if not that part of it, at least some of the criticism or some of the calls for? I know, Louisa, you have very particular questions about or ideas about how we move forward. But do you think there's anything to some of this, that there are ways to rethink some of these things?
I can begin. I think there's no question that we are in the Anthropocene, that our species has had and is having a dramatic effect on the planet to the point where we now are viewed as a geologic force. I think that is true. What I don't think is true is that it's an elitist cause. I think the irony is it is the most inclusive cause because we all breathe the same air and drink the same water. We were talking last night. I think it's interesting that when you think of two significant laws, in 1864, the Yosemite Land Grant, which is really the precursor to the national parks, Abraham Lincoln, in the middle of the Civil War, in the most devastating year, signed this act into law, preserving Yosemite, the valley, and the big trees, the Mariposa Grove. That legislation in the middle of the Civil War. 1964, 100 years later, the Wilderness Act, signed into law by President Johnson in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement. You know, both these acts, I think, were predicated on the open space of democracy, on the public commons, public lands, for every person, everywhere, for all time. That is not elitist.
Lisa, what do you think?
I humbly disagree a little bit with Terry, because I think that the environmental community, as it was constructed, was elitist. Bob Marshall was wealthy. Many, and not Rachel Carson. I mean, there were exceptions. But the white bread nature of the large conservation organizations, which are trying to diversify, Sierra Club, Inner DC, they're all trying to sort of reach out to Hispanics and other people. But it's a little late, and the character of many of these organizations are white bread. And I think that's a problem. Now, the opposite of that is some of the very local, interesting groups starting up in Louisiana dealing with chemicals who are largely black. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, the large national groups that people think of, yes, I think Kariva has a point that we are white bread and can be elitist and look at who's the CEOs of large organizations. But in defiance of that are small organizations popping up all over the place. In my hometown of Livingston, you know, with a train running through it, you know, they say a river runs through it, a train runs through it all. And there are little groups popping up all over the place who are not organized, who are not elitist. They live by the tracks. Their schools are there. And so that's the hope is, yes, the criticism has, I think, some validity, but there are so many interesting efforts refuting that.
Harvey Locke, a Pew Research Center study for the Washington Post last February showed that out of baby boomers, Gen Xers, and the silent generation, millennials, this is those born after 1980, are least likely to call themselves environmentalists. The environmental reporter Paul Voozen was writing about this. He said, the average age of a Nature Conservancy member is 65. The average age of a new member is 62. Only 5% of the group's 1 million members are younger than 40. And he writes, among the conservation-minded, which basically means Americans who've tried recycling, only 8% recognize that particular group. He says, inspiration doesn't cut it anymore. Love of nature is receding. The 60s aren't coming back. Are you worried about this generation coming in and how they're thinking about nature?
Well, I think what at root here is a conflation of the environmental movement structured as a conservation bureaucracy and the concern for nature structured as a social movement. Those are two completely different things. Huh. And so if I were the CEO of an organization with a graying and aging membership, I'd sure be getting the Bequest program going hard to build the big donor base for the future. But that's not the same thing as a conservation movement or concern about conservation. I work all over the world. If you go to the World Wilderness Congress, or I'll be at the World Parks Congress in Sydney, Australia in 6 weeks, every skin color under the rainbow is there, and you sit in that room, and there are people from South Africa, there are people from Taiwan, there are people from all over the world who are every bit as passionate and in love with nature as I am. I've worked with them, I've seen them, I've been speaking tours of India, full of rooms full of Indians, not a white person in the audience, wildly passionate about tigers and wild nature. And this idea, I'm offended actually by this postmodern criticism that it's a white Anglo-Saxon elite that only loves nature and all the other people know better. That is pure garbage. And we had our poet laureate of Montana speak earlier today, who's an Aboriginal person from the Crow Reservation, and he expressed beautifully the love of nature and the spirit that Aboriginal people feel profoundly about the natural world. So again, this is this kind of nonsensical postmodern criticism. The real issue is, how do we get back to the place that motivated, say, the passage of the Endangered Species Act or the passage of the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act? And that was people power. It was concern about the future. It was social motivation. And what we need is a social movement, and we need to quit conflating the environmental movement with its organizations with the concern and motion in society for nature and the future of life on Earth.
John Varley, we need to head to a break here, but I wanted to get your perspective before we do. What do you think about all of this?
Harvey makes a good point and reminds me that over the history of the environmental movement, people tend to leave out the fact that it's actually a partnership between the environmental movement and government that made all of this work. The government are the implementers. And one of the things that I don't like about our society right now is how the naysayers of government have made everyone hate government. And there's certainly reasons to believe that, but they are your implementers. And how government turned into the enemy, not just environmental, but across the board, I think is an unfortunate aspect of our present state.
It's John Varley, biologist who retired as founding director of the Yellowstone Center for Resources, was executive director of the Big Sky Institute at Montana State University. Harvey Locke is with us, writer, photographer, founder of Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative, as well as the Nature Needs Half movement. We have Louisa Wilcox with us, a conservation advocate and with a focus on wildlife in the Northern Rocky Mountains, co-authored The Bear Essentials for Recovery, and of course Terry Tempest Williams, writer, naturalist. Her most recent book is called When Women Were Birds. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West, live from Montana on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting live from Montana, Centennial Valley to be exact. That's where you'll find a center run by the University of Utah's Environmental Humanities Program. We're here discussing the challenges of conserving wildlife in the modern West, talking about whether the conservation movement still works in protecting wild animals and their habitat, or is it time for new ideas, new techniques, new strategies? And we have with us Terry Tempest Williams, John Varley, Harvey Locke, and Louisa Wilcox. So I wanted to ask you, Louisa Wilcox, one of the things that you have said, and you started saying that, and I very rudely interrupted you as you were going to talk about this Zen concept, this old Zen saying, which is beginner's mind, new possibilities, expert mind, few possibilities. I guess that's basically how it goes. Mm-hmm. But how does that apply to the way you're thinking about the new way forward or new strategies, new approaches?
Let me briefly talk about old strategies. 30 years ago, when no one knew what they were doing, and if you didn't have a beginner's mind, and you weren't, in my case, I had no idea what I was doing. And I went to the Forest Service and the Park Service and the states and, you know, ranchers and different, and, you know, I got different ideas. And they said, you know, what about this? What about that? And what I have seen is an ossification of the movement into expertise. You know, I got a master's, I've got an education, but people fit in little boxes. And only in many of these complicated local issues, unless you have a beginner's mind, not an expert mind, like I'm the media expert or I'm the policy person or, you know, I'm the science guy or, you know, whatever. Unless you have a beginner's mind and are porous was the word that Jung used. Unless you are very porous, you aren't necessarily going to see links, bridges, solutions. That's the old way, and also that an old way, and that's also the new way forward. As we've heard speakers like Monty Dolak, unless you see from a raw, humble state what is going on, unless you truly listen, listening is a big problem, you will not see a way forward. And the situations now are so complex. Yes, you need experts. Yes, you need academics. Yes, all that. But unless some people have a complete open mind, you won't see it. And second thing that goes with that.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you what you mean by that. Because you've talked about how you've handled the conflict with grizzly bears and ranchers over the years.
Right.
And you've said that you have to give it time. You have to be patient. Mm-hmm. That you can't act from an ideological point of view. You have to hang in there with people and show up and be honest and acknowledge mm-hmm. their rights mm-hmm. and their... I mean, is that one of these ways of sort of being patient, seeing it with new eyes? Is that what you
yes.
mean?
Yes, and, you know, I spent 10 years working on this logging problem on the west side of Yellowstone Park on the Targhee National Forest, which meant that I got to hang out and become really good friends with loggers down there, small loggers, who said, well, you're about 20 years too late, but, you know, I'll work with you. And I did. And we were able, it was a nasty, multifaceted campaign, but the listening part and the relationships with these loggers, with me, I mean, it wasn't with other environmentalists. I mean, nobody wanted to go down to Eastern Idaho and get beat up by loggers. Actually, they were very, very sweet. And if I didn't have this beginner's mind, listening to Richard Bishop and his 13 kids and, you know, all the rest, I would never have survived turning the corner of excessive logging to more sustainable logging. And yes, we had litigation, yes, we had science, yes, we had a lot of things, but it was really the relationships with the people on the ground who were affected.
Terry, I wanted to get your perspective on that, because you come from a family on the ground. I mean, you've written about the conflict you yourself have felt with members of your family who don't have the same kinds of perspectives about nature and the wild, and they have a perspective about that comes from the private sector, shall we say. And I'm wondering what you've learned yourself about being in the conservation movement, but acknowledging the people on the ground, the human beings affected by regulation and these kinds of things.
You're right. You know, my family has made their living four generations from the land, from what many people would say destroying the land, laying pipe. Their tool of choice is a shovel and a backhoe. You know, and I'll never forget when my father met Edward Abbey. And because my father loves me, he went to a reading by Ed Abbey. And when Edward Abbey, after he finished speaking, my father ran up to the stage, and I thought, there's going to be an act of violence here. Because my father's had many trucks sugared by Monkey Ventures and perhaps even his own daughter. And he went up and said, Mr. Abbey, I'd like to be the first to contribute to your campaign to run for the governor of Arizona. And what that said to me is there's many forms of conservationists. And I've learned that from my family. My uncle, who was a former state senator, the only organization he took money from was the NRA because he knew he would not compromise their standards. And yet he knows, because of our family history and downwinders, that, you know, his wife also belongs to a clan of one-breasted women. And these are issues of health, and it transcends and transects politics to what it means to be human. And I think, you know, we can't forget of where we're having this conversation in the Centennial Valley, and it's a beautiful mosaic of land use. And I was at the Centennial Valley Landowners Meeting, and I was so moved by the rancher, Mr. Huntsman, who talked about being open and participating in strengthening riparian habitat, and the grayling reintroduction program that Bill West, who is the manager of this beautiful refuge, the Red Rocks, Red Rock Lakes National Wildlife Refuge. This is also where the Koch brothers live. It's also where the Nature Conservancy has done tremendous open space initiatives. So we are in the heart of this kind of what could be viewed as conflict or collaboration. And I find terrific and tremendous hope in this. The one point I also want to make, Doug, you talked about how this is an old person's movement, and as a white-haired person, I understand what you're saying. But, you know, on September 20th and 21st, there's going to be a climate change march, and that will largely be young people. And I know the students that I work with here in the Environmental Humanities Program, I have never felt more hopeful, more challenged by their ferocity and commitment than I have by this next generation.
Harvey Locke, you were mentioning earlier that a new story is needed, but it's yet to be written. What do you mean?
Well, all cultures live narratives. Since we're talking a little bit about personal, local, and family experience, my family came west in the 19th century. My people were the first people to pioneer, white people to pioneer in southern Alberta.
I thought you sounded a little Canadian.
Yeah. I'm a lot Canadian. but I'm also a Westerner. And just I'll digress 5 seconds. There's a thing called the 49th parallel. Aboriginal people call it the medicine line. If you're a Westerner from southern Alberta, you've got a heck of a lot in common with a Montanan. Chances are you've got a Mormon relative in Utah.
I thought you looked familiar.
Well, you know, I was just looking at you, Chair, thinking of my LDS aunt, actually. So I really was. I really was.
Really? Would you like a casserole recipe?
But the narrative that people had in their heads were come west, bring progress, use your hard work, your work ethic, convert the land, get your quarter section or section, depending on the homesteading laws, make a new life for yourself, turn it into a productive garden, and be proud of what you've done. And that's deeply ingrained in my family's history, too. And at the same time in the West, people came west and saw Yellowstone and went, wow, we better leave this alone because it's really special. Same thing happened in Banff, where I'm from, up in Canadian Rockies, the world's third national park. Wow, progress consists in leaving this alone. Now, we've had this kind of interesting, weird, Janus-faced life. We're on the plains. We felt free to turn it into a dust bowl, literally. And in the mountains, largely speaking, we've treated it as sacred real estate. And this is a place we go to worship and honor nature. And so you can sit in a city like Calgary or Denver, and at your back is one of the most devastated ecosystems on planet Earth. And in front of you is a place we revere. And that's got to do with the story that we lived. One was the romantic story from the 19th century. The other was the progress narrative from the 19th century. I think in the 21st century, we need a new narrative, one that doesn't dishonor our pioneer roots. I'm very, very proud to be from a pioneer family. My mother was the oldest pioneer lady in the Calgary Stampede Parade 2 years ago. 100th anniversary parade, and my grandmother rode in the first Stampede Parade. That's stuff that really matters to me a lot. But I think we need to accept that the first Westerners, the Aboriginal people or Native Americans, were the ones who better understood what the relationship with the natural world ought to be than those of us who came 6 or 7 generations ago. We are not in charge of the earth. We're one species among many. And in the 21st century, that's what all the biology tells us. That's what the physics tells us. And what's interesting is if the metaphysics, if you will, of Aboriginal people and, interestingly, Indians from India, if you go into Hinduism, everybody understood that the life force that animated the world, and I don't know if you remember the Montana's poet laureate, Mr. Bird, speaking this morning about the life force in the wind and the four-leggeds and the water. That wasn't just about living things. It was about stardust. And we know we are stardust. So we know this through science, and all of us, if you think of the founding image of Western civilization, it's Romulus and Remus, the she-wolf. And what is she doing? She's suckling the two baby humans. So once we understood that we were nurtured by wild nature, and then with Roman civilization, we tossed that off. All Europeans were fundamentally Aboriginal people who had the same cosmology as Aboriginal people and the rest of the world did. We threw that off for the last 2,000 years. It's made us wonderfully prosperous. It's given us the ability to move around the landscape or me to travel the world. I love it. And now it's a problem. Now we're overtaxing the world. We're overfishing the oceans. There was 1 billion of us 150 years ago. Now there's 7 billion of us. It's time for us to adjust, not to dishonor, not to say people were bad, but to say in the face of a new reality, the pioneering work of the 21st century is getting back in line with the rest of nature and being one species among many.
John Varley, how do you imagine, what is that way forward for you? You mentioned really focusing on the minute characters in this bigger picture. Is that one of the things that you're thinking about as a way forward, is focusing on the sort of more holistic view of it all?
The holistic view is very important, Doug. And I think that was an eloquent statement by Harvey Locke just a moment ago. Somehow we've got to get around to giving the same respect of all of our neighboring animals in the world, and including Prochlorococcus. And
that's the word you'll take away from this show, I'm sure, right?
I hope so, because somewhere along the line we need to see that as the charismatic microfauna of the earth that support us, and we gotta quit killing them off. Harvey spoke of the science of the thing, how interconnected we are, and the Indian peoples that had a huge respect for all life around them, Henry Reelbird said earlier this morning, and it's just really important, I think, to make that connection. But to specifically answer your question, I think, as always, the future is dependent upon our youth, and I'm exposed to have been exposed to a lot of environmental education programs in the national park and in schools and that's one of the places that I get hope from.
Yeah, so you feel hopeful about that. John Varley, biologist who retired as founding director of the Yellowstone Center for Resources. Harvey Locke, writer, photographer. Terry Tempest Williams, writer and naturalist. Louisa Wilcox, conservation advocate, with us also. And we are live in Montana in Centennial Valley talking about the conservation movement, and we need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are broadcasting live from Montana in the eastern foothills of the Continental Divide. Centennial Valley is where we are in the town. It's a town, you can call it that. Lakeview once served, as I said, stagecoach stop for tourists on their way to Yellowstone. We're in the Taft-Nicholson Center, or this area is anyway, talking about the future of the conservation movement. And we've been talking with Terry Tempest Williams and John Varley and Harvey Locke and Louisa Wilcox. Terry Tempest Williams, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that you have said is, Louisa, I want to get you on this too, because you've talked about one of the new ways forward is to change the way we see animals, that we've never quite seen them as on par with ourselves, as sentient beings. Is that one of the keys in terms of the way forward, changing the way we see animals?
It's such a good question. You know, for me, I think about what might a different kind of power look like, feel like, and can we extend our notion of power to include other species? Recently, a friend of mine in New York, actually, you know, this is my bias, such an Eastern question. They go, who's the most powerful individual in the American West right now? You know? And I said, the sage grouse. And I think it's true. Because right now the sage grouse yields tremendous power, perhaps the only individual who can truly worry the oil and gas industry. And I think all the states, the six states with which the sage grouse dances in, is having to rethink what their relationship to sage grouse is, so that they aren't held accountable by the Endangered Species Act. You know, personally, my life has been changed by the prairie dogs. And I can only, perhaps you can only imagine the kind of conversations at our dinner tables. Because where I grew, you know, when I grew up,
it was a pop gut.
Yeah. And my father, you know, will tell you, he's shot thousands of them. He would not do that now. And we were just at Teddy Roosevelt Park together, and I actually heard my father, and I'm so sorry that you weren't there to record this, you know, where he said, as we were watching the Prairie Dog Town in North Dakota, he goes, They are sort of cute, aren't they? And I didn't say, Dad, did you just hear what you said? But I think our perceptions are changing because the value of life, I mean, we're just coming out of, we're in the middle of Ferguson. You know, we've just had a reporter beheaded in Syria. Life, there's so much at stake right now. And it's not just the environment. It's the environment in which we live and how we conduct our lives with one another. And animals are part of that. And yes, I do believe our perception has to change. And when the Navajo people, the Diné, said to me, if you take away all the prairie dogs, there will be no one to cry for rain. That is not just a story. That is not just a myth. Without the prairie dogs to aerate the soil in the American Southwest, we are reduced to hard pan.
Louisa, one of the things you've said is we need to shift the debate around animals. You say saving wildlife is about self-restraint and compassion for the other. How are you seeing the way we relate to animals as human beings?
Can I add to that? I think it also, relating to animals and compassion for them, has to do with compassion for ourselves. I think you can't separate them. We are intertwined. Bears are a big part of my life. I love bears. And I've been thinking a lot about bear knowledge, how bears see, grizzly bears see the world, how they know when Yampa's best to pick, how they know Biscuit Root, when to, you know, forage for pondweed in the core of the park, etc. Bear knowledge, seeing through the bear's eyes. And there's an old story called The Women Who Married a Bear, and there's thousands of versions of it. But it really has to do with the kinship of bears and people. And you could say, and the wolves and other species have the same story, really. And it's us learning from bears and bears watching us. And so compassion for ourselves, compassion for the other. I think one of the biggest challenges to changing our relationship with wildlife and finding self-restraint is managing our own egos. And our own egos can be healthy, we all have them, but our egos are kind of out of control. And unless we look profoundly, deeply inside, I've done a lot of work on myself, and all of us probably have in this room, but unless we look profoundly, deeply inside, not whether we recycle, but profoundly, deeply, how we relate to ourselves and our own ego, unless we do that, we can't extend compassion to animals, or really anybody else, whether they live in Gaza or Syria or where. So compassion, self-restraint has to do with managing our most deep inside self.
Harvey Locke, you've pointed out that recent work with DNA shows that we humans have a strong, we now know we have this genetic kinship, as you put it, with other species. But you say this, you say we also know our species is different and now pretty dominant. So the Aboriginal perspective that you've been talking about, you say that provides the way for us to acknowledge that fact, but not lose perspective. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, I'm really struck by how there's been this convergence through different paths of traditional indigenous knowledge and Western science. And the way Henry Marshall III talks about, as he said, the Lakota Sioux understood that the bear is powerful because he's strong, the eagle is powerful because he has good eyesight, and the human is powerful because he can reason. And so it doesn't mean that we are suddenly abandon the fact that we can think in an abstract way, which perhaps other species can't or can do so to a lesser degree. Dolphins and elephants turn out to be pretty darn smart. But
yeah.
The deeper point is that when we understand that we are one species among many with a particular set of gifts unique to our species, then we can continue to develop fully as human beings, but perhaps in a much less destructive way. And this concept of ego that Louisa touched on, I think, is really important. It's also a kind of a convergence of Western psychology and traditional indigenous worldview. For example, as eminent Jungian psychologist C.A. Meyer said, that when we destroy the wilderness, when we destroy wild nature, humans lose humility. And when they lose humility, when they stop being watchful and humble and they think they control the world, then we turn nasty. And if you think about the wiping out of species, the great extinction of large mammals in Europe occurred only in about late 1700s. That's exactly when Europeans emigrated to the New World, too. So that's, we're all connected in that. They then got very warlike, very nasty, and a lot of very, very, very bad things happened with European wars, as we know, in the last 150 years.
And I'm going to jump in there because we're about out of time. Harvey, forgive me.
Please.
We're essentially out of time, and I wanted to give John Varley the sort of the final word here, as we're out of time. John, like 30 seconds, you feel positive about this stuff? I mean, there's a lot of conflict to talk about. There's a lot. But earlier, you sounded like you might be kind of optimistic about all of this.
Well, I am optimistic, and I think there are two things that I'd say.
And say them briefly. I'm so sorry.
One is let's recall that Ecclesiastes, 6,000 years ago, said that we are alike with all of the other animals on earth. We are no different, and so it's not a new idea. But it's one we need to pay more respect to.
That is John Varley, a biologist who retired as founding director of the Yellowstone Center for Resources. Harvey Locke, writer and photographer. Terry Tempest Williams, of course, writer and naturalist. And Louisa Wilcox, conservation advocate. Thank you all very much for being with us. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks today to Leslie Miller, the director of the Reimagine Western Landscapes Symposium. That's where we are. And to the staff of the Taft Nicholson Environmental Humanities Center. A lot of thanks to Mary Tull and Frank Carter and John Momberger. We had help from Michael Shea and Mike Anderson back in the studio. Our thanks also to our engineer, Lewis Downey, and Adrian Moranville. Here in Montana, Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.